but cannot happen. There's the next issue that was raised in terms of individual transfers, and that is that employees, there's a sense that employees will be imposed on other institutions. And what we are saying is that that cannot happen, because built again into the provisions of PAMA is a provision that requires that both EAs must agree to a transfer of an employee. So apart from the fact that an employee must agree and consent to a transfer, it is also a prerequisite that the executive authority of a transferring department, as well as the executive authority of a recipient department, must consent to that transfer. So employees can never be imposed on other institutions by way of transfer. There was also an issue raised around the relocation costs and other costs that may emanate from transfers. Currently, these costs are provided for in existing collective agreements. So if you look in the public service, you'll find provisions and collective agreements that deal with these in terms of allowances. And similarly, there would be other provisions that that deal with allowances that are payable relocation. Where there are gaps that exist, we will address those matters either through collective agreements or through relevant processes and regulations. The next clause deals with secondment, and I want to clarify that the amendment in terms of clause 3 does not seek to amend the principal act in terms of content and the context of secondment. So currently the principal act provides that an employee must be seconded without the consent after due consideration of representation by the employee, if the secondment is justified. So it allows for an employee to provide consent, and where consent is not provided, then due representation must be taken by the employee to facilitate that transfer if it's justified. What we have done to this provision is we've inserted the word operationally before justified. So we say that the secondment must be operationally justified. And what that means is that that secondment must then relate to the work of the affected department. So it can't be arbitrary. We tried to strengthen the provision to avoid the arbitrary secondments, and that was the intention of the provision. So it wasn't to introduce secondments, because secondments is already in the Act itself. This was just a measure to ensure that when employees are seconded, it must be justified within the work and activities of the institution. We also don't believe that operationally justified needs to be defined. It takes the ordinary meaning of the word, and as I've indicated, the ordinary meaning is that it must relate to the work or activities of the institution. In terms of Clause 5 of the Bill, and this deals with conducting business with an organ of state, there was a proposal that we should define what we mean by ex officio. So in the bill itself, we have inserted a provision that says that persons who are appointed ex officio as a director of a company does not fall within the scope of doing business with the state. And this emanates from the fact that in the public service and in the public administration generally, there are public entities to which members of the executive appoint employees to serve on those boards as part of their duties in the departments. And what we are saying that that ability to serve as a director on those public entities or on those boards then cannot be construed as that employee doing business with the state. But in terms of this particular proposal that we insert a definition for ex officio, we don't believe that it's necessary to define it, but in the event that the committee believes that it is necessary, then we have provided a definition that we think might assist the process. And that basically is to say that ex officio relates to an employee who holds office as a director of a public entity solely as a consequence of that employee's employment in the public administration. And we hope that that insertion will then assist the process. Again, remaining with the provisions of conducting business with the state, we have in Section 8.4 of the bill, we have inserted a provision that seeks to allow the Minister for Public Service and Administration to determine certain activities that will not fall within the scope of conducting business with the state. And this is simply a provision that allows the minister to deal with the unintended consequences that arise from the provision contained in Section 8. What's how the provision reads, and I'm just going to read it for context. In the proposed Section 8.4, we say the minister may prescribe that certain transactions between an employee and an organ of state, which are remunerative but not for profit, do not constitute conducting business with an organ of state for the purposes of this section. What we have done is that if you look at Section 8, it creates a blanket prohibition on employees not conducting business with the state. And the unintended consequence is that there are certain employees who, as a matter of the performance of certain functions, they are required to do this business with the state in a sense that it allows the state to function and perform its duties. And the example is that when you have educators who mark exam papers, they receive remuneration for that. They do business with the state if you look at the true sense of Section 8. But the intention was not to prohibit that marking to take place. And if it falls within the scope of that, the unintended consequence is that you might not have and you will not have educators who would be willing to mark these exam papers for fear of falling foul of criminal proceedings that are envisaged under Section 8. So basically what the provision does in 8.4 that we've inserted is that it allows our minister to determine what these activities may be and then to provide them through regulation. The reason it can't at this stage be put into the law itself is because we don't have a defined list of these activities. Because it's a moving target, these activities may come up and we're just not aware of them at this stage. It makes it hard to put it in the law itself. Ideally, we should have, but we just can't find a closed list that we could put into the law. So we are suggesting that that list be determined through regulation. In terms of Section 8.4, again, as I said, that provision is enables the minister to determine that closed list. But as we determine that list, what we have also put into the provision is that the minister, in determining that list, must ensure that those employees that fall within that list receive remuneration but do not profit from that provision. So we are very clear to ensure that what that list must contain is not a mechanism that will allow employees to profit off the state. The second issue that we have provided in terms of limiting possible limiting or creating possible parameters within which the minister will create that list is that we could possibly look at also inserting the words and which are necessary for the functioning of an organ of state. And we're hoping that these words will give comfort in the legislation itself, that the list that is finally determined through regulations by the minister will not circumvent or will not lead to an abuse of this provision. There is also a proposal that we revise the provision to allow for employees to be directors of non-profit companies. We are suggesting as the department that we do not support the proposal that employees should be directors of any company, even in the circumstances of non-profit. There have been instances where employees who have been directors of non-profit companies have abused and have had conflicts of interest in the performance of their duties in relation to that work. Still continuing on conducting business with the state, there is a request as part of the consultation process that we consider the issue of beneficial ownership. It was raised in the context of what is currently in the public procurement bill, etc. And what we have looked at as a department is how then could we best look at the issue of beneficial ownership within the scope of the department and within the scope of this particular legislation. What we have determined is that the National Treasury is looking at this issue more extensively, and it is envisaged that the bills under National Treasury will then consider beneficial ownership in more detail. What we are doing as a department is that we are looking at how we strengthen our financial disclosure processes and how we deal with the consequent lifestyle audits that will be undertaken and that are currently being undertaken to determine whether there is unexplained wealth. And usually with beneficial ownership during those processes, you are able to detect that wealth that comes out of beneficial ownership. And there are also provisions within the relevant law enforcement agency acts that allow for those agencies to then deal with unexplained wealth in that context. So we believe that for now we will deal with it through financial disclosure processes and those that exist. It is also proposed in Section 8 that we should also prohibit employees who are employed in public entities to also be prohibited from doing business with the state. For purposes of this bill, we have not looked at the research and policy direction in that particular area. It is work that we will undertake, and it is possibly work that we will propose further amendments if necessary to these bills to include it. But we are also aware that there is a process by the Department of Public Enterprises to manage and deal with public entities holistically. In terms of clause 14, there is a provision that we've inserted. It's section 17A. And what section 17A does, and this is just extracted from the bill itself, it says that in order to remove unjustifiable disparities in relation to remuneration and conditions of service in the public administration, the minister may, subject to applicable labor laws, any collective agreement and legislation governing employment of employees in the public administration, and after consultation with the relevant minister responsible, prescribe, and prescribe in that context means through regulations. So the minister may prescribe norms and standards to establish upper limits of remuneration and conditions of service for employees who do not fall within the scope of the bargaining council. What that provision does is that it allows the minister to establish norms and standards, not to set the upper limits, but to establish norms and standards for employees who are not part of a bargaining council, and that refers to your managers. It's usually those that salaries and conditions of service are not negotiated within a bargaining council. The B part of that also allows the minister through regulations to prescribe steps to remove unjustifiable disparities amongst employees in the public administration. And what we have added in that is that these steps may not reduce the salary of an employee except in terms of an act of parliament or a collective agreement. There has been a proposal to add the words that are underlined in the slide. So there is a request that we should add, should not reduce the salary and conditions of service of employees. And what we are saying to that proposal is that particular provision, and I'm just going to put it in front so that we see it. So what we are saying is that the B part of Section 17A seeks to deal with disparities that exist either between jobs or between activities and any other employment matters that relate within the public administration to ensure that we don't have disparities. Usually it's disparities around salaries, disparities around matters that should not have these disparities. So as part of our processes to look at disparities, we have also been cognizant that different institutions operate in different environments, and there will always be different needs and different requirements for jobs, and that in itself will cause disparities. There's also collective agreements that take place in different spheres of government, which also then create justified disparities. And what we are saying is we are not touching any of those. We are looking at those disparities that cannot be justified. So if you have a legal person who is employed in Department A and you have a legal person doing the same function employed in Department B, there should be no real difference between their salaries and conditions of service in that regard. So what we are then saying is that as a state, we have to organize better to ensure that where there's unjustifiable disparities, and I really want to emphasize unjustifiable, where there are unjustifiable disparities, then the state should be in a position to try and remedy that. In fact, it is one of the requirements under the Employment Equity Act that any employer must remove unjustifiable disparities, and we are seeking to do exactly that. But as we do that, we are also wary that we cannot reduce the salary of employees. Now, the insertion of conditions of service will mean that we cannot reduce conditions of service for also employees who do not fall within the bargaining council. So it is a usual practice that when we deal with conditions of service of employees who fall within the bargaining council, those employees are dealt with through collective bargaining, etc. But for employees who fall outside the scope of the bargaining council, then conditions of service is not subject to any collective agreement and cannot be subject to any collective agreement. So the insertion of the words and conditions of service of an employee, except in terms of an act of parliament or collective agreement, will undermine that provision. So we are suggesting that those words not be inserted. What we are suggesting, if there is still discomfort and the committees of the view that the words, the words conditions of service should be clarified somewhere, we are then suggesting that we amend the scope of Section 17A, because I think the concern comes from organized labor. We are suggesting then in Section 17A that the entire Section 17A then be limited to employees who do not fall within the scope of a bargaining council, and that way there is no impact on conditions of service, etc. And we've considered a redraft that we've provided in the last paragraph of this particular slide. I'm just going to jump up. There was also the issue of unjustifiable disparities, and there was a proposal that the department should consider defining what an unjustifiable disparity is. And again, we are saying that this particular definition is capable of ordinary meaning definition. It is not necessary to provide unjustifiable disparities as a definition. And we also suggest again that this proposal and this requirement by law is already contained in the Employment Equity Act, and there is no further need to define it. Again, in terms of Clause 14, and this is now Section 17B of the bill, this provision seeks to deal with mandating arrangements for conditions of service that are determined within the public administration. What we have proposed in the bill that is before the committee is that subject to the Labor Relations Act and the laws governing the employment of employees and any collective agreement. So we've made this provision subject to all of that. So the idea is not to undermine the LRA, not to undermine any laws governing employees, and not to undermine any collective agreement. We say that no employer in the public administration may enter into a collective agreement without a mandate from the Committee of Ministers. And this simply is to allow the state to manage its finances at a holistic, in a holistic manner that takes into account all spheres of government, including public entities. I think when we hear the Minister of Finance give his budget speech in the coming days, we will also understand the pressures that are being put on the state in terms of conditions of service and managing the finances of the public administration. So it is much more necessary to find mechanisms to deal with the finances of the state. And we believe that these matters that get negotiated within bargaining chambers and get determined for members of the SMS and the senior management of the public administration must also be cognizant of the financial constraints that we have, because getting into collective agreements and then not being able to afford them is also creating difficulties for the state to manage its finances. So understanding that, and I think in all our engagements with organized labor, with public, there is a recognition that the state needs to manage its finances. There is no doubt about that. But I think how we do that and how we manage it is important. Labor has, and through these participation processes, raised concerns that there is a feeling that national government is impeding into local government to the extent that requiring a mandate from a committee of ministers is too prescriptive and may affect collective bargaining. We don't believe constitutionally that it does. What we say in this process is that we are dealing with creating a process to mandate agreements to the extent that that agreement becomes affordable and there is enough budgeting, there is foresight in those processes, and it's done at a macro level. But what we are understanding from labor is that they believe that it offends the Constitution. And what we are proposing, if the committee is also of the view that we have gone too far in these proposals to create a centralized process, we are suggesting that at the very least, in respect of local government and public entities, that those institutions be required to consult at least the Minister of Finance and the Minister for Public Service and Administration before agreements are entered into. And we're only dealing with agreements that have financial implications. We are also proposing that if the committee goes along those lines of dealing separately with local government and public entities outside of a committee of ministers, that the current provisions in relation to the public service remain, where the public service employers must get a committee of ministers to mandate those agreements. And that is the current practice. And it works within the public service, so we are asking that be retained. There is also a provision in Section 17B, which says in determining a mandate that those institutions must ensure that that agreement takes into account affordability and any other factors by the minister, any other factors prescribed by the minister in consultation with the Minister of Finance. So we are requesting the Portfolio Committee, in the event that the committee believes that the provision in its current form might create challenges, we are asking the committee to then look at the alternative proposals that are contained in those last four bullets of the slide. Chair, I want to stop here, and I want to hand over to Prof. Cheadle. As DG indicated, there have been issues around the constitutionality of the bill, and what we have requested is Professor Cheadle to perhaps share his views on the constitutionality of the PAM bill in its entirety, as well as the constitutionality of Section 17A and B. Prof, with your permission.
Good morning, Chair and members of the Portfolio Committee. Can you hear me?
Yes, you are loud and clear.
Okay. Let me begin by just stating that I'm an attorney and a consultant at the firm Bradley, Conradi, Health and Cheadle, and I'm a professor emeritus from UCT. And I've been working, as the DG said, assisting the department, the minister and the department with this particular bill. And really, very early on, the issue of the constitutionality of these proposals was extensively discussed. And they've been drafted in order to ensure that they are constitutional. And as the slide shows, the bill, we argue, gives effect to Section 41, brackets one, brackets of the Constitution, in that it recognizes the distinctive, independent, and related natures of national, provincial, and local government. And secondly, and I really, that's the autonomy argument that you heard last week, where they were saying that that you couldn't pass national legislation, that it was an encroachment on the autonomy of the municipal administration. Was the argument that encroached on them. Now, in response, I think if you look at section 164, and I refer you to 164, which I'll read, it says any matter concerning local governments not dealt with in the Constitution may be prescribed by national legislation. So it's quite clear that if it's not contained in the Constitution, then it's national legislation. And if you have a look at the matters in respect of which the local government is given autonomy, and those are set out in parts B to schedules 4 and 5. And if one looks at those matters, one will see that that labor and employment relations are not listed. The lists, are air pollution, building regulations, childcare facilities, local tourism, municipal airports, municipal planning. Just having a look at what's contained in those parts, those are the parts that the administration has autonomy. So accordingly, labor relations, collective bargaining, employment conditions are national legislative competencies. And as we indicate in the slide, the existing legislative frameworks include Labor Relations Act, the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, the Employment Equity Act, and even Staff Matters in the Municipal Systems Act. Those are all national pieces of legislation. And they all, to that extent, apply to local government. And accordingly, the Palmer Act, which is also a piece of national legislation, is not encroaching on the autonomy of local government. The second argument, which is the next slide, the second argument is that it's an infringement of the right to collective bargaining. Now, we argue that, the new section 17A and B do not infringe the right to collective bargaining. And we say so because, first of all, both sections clearly indicate that the removal of unjustifiable disparities is subject to the LRA and collective agreements. And again, you see the same similar language in section 70B. Now, if one has a look at the mandating procedure, which is the one that is presently contained, and the consulting procedure, which is the one has also been proposed, neither of them interfere with collective bargaining. The mandating stage or the consultancy stage precedes collective bargaining. And I think it's really quite important to recognize that the collective agreement is not being approved by the Committee of Ministers or by the Minister of Finance or the Minister responsible for COGPA. It's the mandate. And that means that if Labour does not agree with Selga's mandated offer after the mandating process or consulting process, the unions are free to go on strike or refer the dispute to arbitration in respect of essential services. And by the way, if it's referred to arbitration, that arbitration binds the state without any approval from the minister, the Committee of Ministers, or the Minister of Finance. And the same thing applies to the agreement that is finally struck if the unions are successful in using their economic power to force a renewed mandate from the Council of Ministers. And so therefore, constitutionally, what is proposed in the Amendment Act before you and the revision that Ms. Naidu has put forward, neither of them constitute an infringement of collective bargaining. And accordingly, neither of the sections are unconstitutional. Thank you.
Chair, sorry, with permission, if I can just then conclude on the last slide. There was also a constitutional worry that sections 17A and 17B infringes on the mandate of the Minister of COGTA in that process. And what we want to respond to that is that what this bill does, or what the Public Administration Management Act does, is that it gives management of this act in terms of regulations to the Minister of Finance, the Minister of COGTA, as well as the Minister for Public Service and Administration. So all three ministers have a role in the implementation of this particular piece of legislation, recognizing the respective roles of those ministers. So in Section 18, if you look at the regulations themselves and the process to make regulations, what we are saying is that the regulations are made by the Minister of COGTA as well as the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Public Service and Administration. That is the end of our presentation. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much. Ms. Naidu. Honorable members, that's the end of the detailed presentation from the Department of Public Service and Administration. They have responded to all issues and they've clarified some of them as per the two public hearings last week. I will then take hands of for clarities from honorable members if there are clarities from this presentation. Can I take hands, honorable members? There's one hand of Honorable Notnachal. Okay, there's Honorable Notnachal, there's Honorable Kibi.
Thank you, Chair. Can I ask my question?
Yes, if you want to ask questions for clarities, you can go ahead, Honorable Nognaga.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to everybody on the platform. I would just like to say thank you for the presentation, and I'm very happy to see the work that has been done so far regarding the proposed amendments. So first of all, I would just like to make a statement and ask a question. It was proposed that Section 8, in brackets 4 of the bill, might be open to abuse and should be deleted. So the department has proposed that A, possible further amendment to Clause 8 4 could be that the minister might prescribe that certain transactions between an employee and an organ of state, which are remunerative but not for profit and which are necessary for the functioning of an organ of state, do not constitute conducting business with an organ of state for the purposes of this section. Why should it be tentative as the minister may prescribe and not affirmative to say the minister must prescribe, as this will enable a thorough consideration of acceptable conditions, and can it be adapted rather than being in the bill as proposed? I thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Nognakhal, Honorable Kiwi.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning to you. I'm going to switch off my video, Chair. Good morning to yourself, the Honorable Chair, and good morning to the Deputy Minister, Honorable Members, and the Department. Honorable Chair, let me also join my colleague in welcoming the presentation and also the responses from our last meeting that we had last week, responses on issues that were raised and also clarities on some of the issues. I want to join Honorable Nognaga, but to say also on the clause on secondment, Honorable Chair, operational requirements can create instances of abuse where executives can move to various departments and continually second particular senior managers to the various organizations. What measures will mitigate this possibility? And also in relation to conducting business with state organs, it will be necessary to have regulations that should set clear parameters to negate abuse. What are the current abuses and limitations the clause seeks to address, and how will its abuse be prevented, Honorable Chair? Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Kiwi. I think those are the three questions to the department, DG. If you want to lead and respond to a few questions or clarities from members.
Thank you, Chair. I'll ask the team first, Renisha, to please give response to the questions. I'll come back afterwards. Renisha?
Thank you. Sorry, DG. Maybe I want to start with the may and the must in Section 8.4. One of the reasons we put may instead of must is that when we make regulations, there's certain requirements for us to follow in terms of getting those regulations promulgated. And during those processes, you might find that it is not necessary to regulate. So, for example,
if we use the issue of teachers, we want to put teachers on this list as an exemption to the provision. And if later on there are different processes within the Department of Basic Education that then no longer compensates those teachers or no longer, or teachers, or there's another mechanism that's found that teachers are not falling within the list itself, or that the list becomes unnecessary, then it is not necessary then for the minister to issue or prescribe any regulations in that regard. And if you create a must, it means that the minister must do it, whether it's necessary or not. And that's the challenge we have with legislation. And that's why the wording of may is usually preferred over a must. It's simply to allow a situation where there is no need for that regulation and therefore the must falls away. If you use the must, it means the minister must do something, whether it's necessary or not. And her failure to do that will mean that she is acting contrary to the law. So we are proposing that in that respect, the may be retained. In terms of the abuse to long-term secondments, one of the things the bill does and the Act does as well is to ensure that secondments are a temporary measure. And I'm just going to, sorry, open this. So there's very strict parameters if you look at secondments. It says an employee of an institution may be seconded to another institution on terms and conditions. And what it says is that, sorry, I'm just going to find the relevant section. My apologies, you'll just bear with me. So the provision says that secondments will be regulated, the manner and the terms and conditions of the manner and terms and conditions of secondments will be done through regulations. And what we are proposing in this is that as we move towards the finalization of regulations, we will also look at measures to ensure that secondments do not become long-term secondments, because the idea with secondments is to solve a short-term need. It is not necessarily to fill a position somewhere else, because secondments is an alternative temporary measure to transfers. If you want to transfer someone to another position on a permanent basis to fulfill those permanent duties, then you must use the transfer provision. Secondments is different to the extent that it envisages a short-term secondment. And the reason why it must be short-term is simply because when an employee is seconded from Department A to Department B, the employee leaves a gap in Department A, which needs to then be fulfilled by existing resources within that institution. So you don't want to leave that gap for too long. So the idea is that on secondments, it's temporary, and we will clarify that through regulations that will have to be enacted to ensure that those processes are managed efficiently and effectively. Vijay, I'm sorry, I didn't get the section on the last question, but perhaps colleagues on the platform who got the last question can assist me, please. Prof, I don't know if you got the last question.
The last question I have on my side was in relation to doing business with the state. I think you attended to that one, unless maybe Chair can remind us if we've missed something. Thank you.
No, I think Ms. Naidu have responded to the questions by the honourable members, DG, except you want to add to what she has said so that we move to the next presentation.
I'm good, Chair. Thank you very much. I don't need to add anything.
No, thank you very much, DG. I think, honourable members, the department responses clarifies various clauses and address some misconceptions and misunderstanding from the presentations and obvious the issues that were raised on PAMA during the hearings. And as such, honourable members, we are moving to the next presentation, which is the last presentation of this meeting.
Just before Renisha starts, I don't know, with your permission, if you could release Professor Schittel from the meeting.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, DG.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Prof. Renisha, are you still with us?
Yes, DG, my apologies. I'm just trying to load up the second presentation. You'll tell me as soon as you can see it.
It's not showing yet on my side.
Can you see it yet, DG?
Yes, it's showing now, Renisha. Thank you. You can put it on presentation format.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So this is the Public Service Amendment Bill and the comments that emanated again from last week's discussions and the discussions prior. In terms of the first comment that was received was that we should remove the ambiguity and provide further clarification on the role of ministers, MECs, and the president in relation to heads of department. What we have done in the bill and what we had envisaged would ensure that these roles were clarified was in the bill that was submitted to the portfolio committee. We indicated in the amendments in the definitions that are contained in the first clause of the bill that the definition of executive authority be reconsidered, and it's one of the amendments that are before the committee. What we are saying in that particular, and I've copied and pasted that provision, we say that executive authority in relation to the presidency or a national government component within the president's portfolio means the president. An executive authority in relation to a national department or a national government component means the president. And in relation to a head of the office of a premier or provincial department and provincial government component means the relevant premier. And then the provision goes further down to determine who is the EA in respect of national and provincial departments, as well as offices of the premier and the office of the public service commission. So we are hoping that this definition that we are highlighting would address then that comment about the roles and responsibilities. So wherever we refer to EA in that context of HODs particularly, the paragraph B of that definition then applies. Again, the issue of the insertion of words was requested to be done as part of the consultation. This is clause or section 39A of the bill, which is clause 2. And what has been proposed, and currently 39A reflects what is on the screen at the moment. The words that I have underlined
is what has been proposed by the comment process, and we are not averse to that clarity being inserted. There is a sense that when a head of department fails to take steps that the EA or the executive authority has instructed on, then it is incumbent, it's a must, that the executive authority must report that to the president or the premier. We are in agreement and we are not averse to making that change. So we're proposing the change as well. In terms of clause 3 of the bill, which is section 5, in clause 3, the only amendment that was sought to section 5 was the replacement of the words head of department with the words, we're replacing the words executive authority with the words head of department to allow the head of department to also deal with matters that may arise. What is currently in the Principal Act is a period of 3 years within which HOD or an executive authority may deal with the career incidents of a former employee. And what is contained in that act is that the period within which that HOD or executive authority may deal with that matter is limited to 3 years unless there's a reason otherwise. And the question being asked in this comment process is, why do we talk about a 3-year period? And the 3-year period is primarily based on and aligned to the Prescription Act, which usually says that you should deal with matters within a period of 3 years, and any dispute arising from a matter that occurred over three years does not have the ability to be determined or decided upon. And that simply is to create parameters so that employees can't come 10 years after something has happened and expect that something can be done with this. So I think it's simply that, but if there needs to be further clarity in the memorandum, we will then provide it. But the 3 years was not part of the amendment itself. In terms of clause 4, section 7.3 of the Principal Act, there is a proposal that a new section 3F or subsection 3F be inserted into the bill, which provides, as it's written in green, a head of department shall perform the functions of, shall perform the powers entrusted or assigned to him or her free of interference by any political office. Any interference into the independent performance of powers in terms of this section or hindrance of the performance of such powers must be reported directly to the president. So what this envisages is that if there is undue pressure on a head of department, that a head of department should then have the ability to report directly to the president on it. What we are proposing is that under Section 35, there are processes that are prescribed where a head of department who is aggrieved by any process, and that includes interference, can then lodge grievances with the Public Service Commission, and it is then the Public Service Commission who, as an independent arbiter to these processes, may direct on possible remedial action. So we believe that provision is not necessary to be inserted into the Act because it might create difficulties in implementation if you look at that particular insertion and then what is contained in Section 35 of the Act. In terms of Clause 4, and this is dealing with Section 7.3b2, there is a proposal that the head of the Office of the Premier should be responsible for cooperative and intra-governmental relations between provincial departments in the event of disputes. And there is a request that there should be expressed provision in this regard made in the amendment bill. We have looked at the amendment bill and we are confident that we have dealt with this matter because the bill currently provides that the head of the Office of the Premier is responsible for intra-governmental cooperation between the relevant office and various provincial departments. So we believe that provision should address that concern. In clause 4, section 7.3, there is also a request that consideration be given in the bill to provide a role for the Public Service Commission in supporting appointment processes in departments and in the public service. Usually, the Public Service Act requires and sets out key principles for appointment, etc. But the actual processes that are required for recruitment are prescribed through regulations. And what we are proposing is that as we consider regulations to align with the Amendment Act, we will then also consider the role of the Public Service Commission in the recruitment processes. We also note that the Public Service Commission has a constitutional oversight responsibility that we must consider as we determine what their role should be in these processes, and that will be done through regulations as well. So it will not be contained in this particular act. I think I also want to mention that there is already work underway between the Public Service Commission and the DPSA in respect of how the Public Service Commission can play a role in strengthening appointment processes. The next provision deals with, and it's a general provision that deals with how we have vested powers with HODs and that versus the powers of executive authorities. And there is a concern that by divesting or by vesting administrative powers with HODs, there will be a diminished oversight role that the executive authority would play, and that the executive authority would then, in light of the vesting of administrative powers with HODs, be then reliant on the HOD providing that executive authority with the necessary information. What we have done throughout the development of the Public Service Amendment Bill was to ensure that as we vested administrative powers with HODs, we also were very cognizant of the role that the executive authority had to play in the management of a department or an institution, to the extent that we ensured that strategic powers continue to be vested with the executive authority, and purely administrative matters were vested with the HOD. And as we did this, the thinking around that was that we had to align administrative powers with financial responsibilities to ensure that there was synergy in the way the administration ran, and that responsibilities with the HOD. But we've also put in place checks and balances to ensure that there is accountability by the HOD to the executive authority. We've also put in the provision which I spoke to earlier about section 3.7, which then allows an executive authority to intervene if an HOD refuses or fails to fulfill a power in terms of the Act. And I think the one thing that possibly needs more emphasis is that the Public Service Act deals with public servants and the management of public servants. The functional responsibility of every executive authority remains with that executive authority. So if we refer to the powers vested with the Minister for Public Service and Administration as the minister responsible for that functional area, the powers to set norms and standards remain with the Minister for Public Service and Administration, similarly to all the other functional responsibilities associated with other ministers and other premiers and MECs. So the bill does not seek to divest those powers. The bill purely seeks to take away administrative, routine, mundane, day-to-day operations of a department and vest that with HODs. The next issue in terms of clause 6 was that there was concern that as we go through the Public Service Act amendment, that there is conflict between what is contained in the Public Service Amendment Bill and the SAPS Act. And what I would like to draw to the attention of of the committee is that in Section 2.2 of the Public Service Act, as it currently is, there is already an overriding provision that protects the employment of employees that are employed by other statutes. So what Section 2.2 says is that if there is a conflict between the Public Service Act and any law governing the employment of another employee in the services or in the services, will the employment legislation applicable to that employee will prevail over the Public Service Act. So there is already a mechanism within the statute itself to deal with any conflict that may arise between the different employment legislation. I think we recognize that the educators are employed under a different act, the correctional services, the SAPs, etc. So there is provision to manage those, and it has been managed in the past. There is also a concern that was raised, and I think it's an important matter to note as the committee engages on the bill. What we have done in, so the concern is that Section 14 of the Public Service Act was repealed by the Public Administration Management Act in 2014. What we have done through both the amendment of the Public Administration Management Act and the Public Service Act is that we have retained the Section 14 of the Public Service Act through a reenactment in the Public Administration Management Bill of Section 14. So that repeal never happened because we never brought that provision into operation because it created challenges in the way transfers were managed in the public service. So what we are now proposing for transfers and Section 14 is that Section 14 of the Public Service Act will continue to be operational. It will continue to be effective. The repeal that happened under Palmer will be taken away. And what Palmer will do, and this arose from the many consultations we've had, is that Palmer will only deal with transfers insofar as it's transfers from the public service to municipalities, municipalities to the public service, and between municipalities. So it's not going to deal with transfers between national and provincial government or vice versa. I hope I clarified that. So Section 14 very much remains in the Public Service Act, and therefore the amendment proposed to Section 14 is necessary. In terms of Clause 12, there is a request that we consider an appeal process for persons or employees who are requesting to perform other remunerative work. What generally happens under Section 30 is that an employee who wants to perform other remunerative work is required then to seek the permission of the head of department. In the current Act itself, in the Principal Act, that permission is currently sought from the executive authority, but through the amendment and the vesting of administrative powers, we are proposing that that permission now be dealt with by the head of the department. We do not believe that that process requires an appeal process because the decision of the head of department should be binding. It is simply a request to request permission, and we don't think that it has an implication on the current employment processes that would necessitate a review process within the department again. It just becomes administratively burdensome for departments to deal with, in addition to the initial request to deal with an appeal process. I think we're moving away from burdening administration processes, and we are saying that it's not necessary. In terms of the next comment on that section, there is a request that we consider extending the period for deemed approvals for employees who request to perform other remunerative work. Currently under Section 30, there is a provision that says if an employee requests permission to perform outside remunerative work and the employee does not get a decision or the employer does not make a decision on that application, then that application is deemed to be approved after a period of 30 days has expired. There is a request to possibly extend the provision we are not necessarily averse to extending the provision, but I think consideration at the time of enacting this particular provision in the current Public Service Act, the thinking behind that was that when an employee makes a request to perform outside remunerative work, there is generally an understanding that that employee has to then either accept that outside remunerative work within a reasonable period, and therefore the decision on whether or not that person can accept through the permission of the EA or the HOD now in this case, becomes dependent, one becomes dependent on the other. So to extend this to 40 days or 60 days might then compromise the ability of the employee to actually undertake that outside remunerative work when the permission is ultimately provided. So we think 30 days remains a viable option, but again, we are in the hands of the committee. I think what's important is that the intention of the amendment that's before the portfolio committee was not necessarily to deal with an amendment to the period. It was to deal with the vesting of those powers with the HOD. Again, in terms of clause 14, there is a concern that we have provided in section 32 for acting appointments. And there is a concern that by doing that, we are creating a deterrent for departments to fill posts. So there's a sense that if we took away the ability to allow people to act in positions, departments may fill their posts in a better way. What we are proposing to the committee is that acting arrangements are temporary. They're short-term and they're aimed at filling a gap that exists in the immediate. And examples of that is where a person retires or resigns or exits the system and the post is vacant, but the processes to fill that post require advertisement, they require selection committees, et cetera, and that usually takes in a good system, it should take about 3 to 4 months. And what we are saying for those particular circumstances is that Section 32 is enabling the department to appoint an employee, an existing employee, to act in those positions to ensure that the functions of that job are still continued and there's no disruptions in the system. Especially relevant to Section 32 and the need for Section 32 is especially found in those departments, in those posts where if there is no one acting there, there is a serious compromise on service delivery. So things may not happen that should happen in that particular job, especially where there are decision-making jobs. Decisions need to continue to be made. You can't wait 4 months before a post is filled before you can have that decision made. I think what's also important in the public service is that we have strengthened through the revision of our regulations the timelines within which departments must fill their posts. So it is also concomitantly, we accept the comment. We think Section 32 is not the way to fix it, but we have found measures within the regulations to force departments to fill posts within the shortest time possible. There is also concern in terms of Section 32 that it is impractical to require that the Premier be consulted when appointing a head of department for a day or a short period of leave. And what we are saying in Section 32 is simply that when a vacant post, so there is nobody in that post, when a post of HOD is vacant, then the Premier or the President must be consulted when the Minister appoints a person to act as the head of department. So the idea is not to consult the Premier or the President when a HOD is on leave for 2 days. The provisions are clear that when the HOD is on leave for those particular short periods of time, then the HOD may appoint someone to act in his or her absence. So we think that that provision will not create the challenge that is foreseen. In terms of Clause 15, there is concern that the time periods for grievances and managing disciplinary processes are not contained in the Act. What Section 35 does is that it clarifies who makes rules in terms of grievances, and that is a requirement to ensure that grievances are properly managed. In terms of the processes themselves, both from a grievance perspective as well as a disciplinary process, those are dealt with outside of the primary law. The grievance rules dictate, as well as the disciplinary codes dictate time periods. And as we give effect, once these amendments have been passed, once we give effect to the concomitant rules that are required for the grievance procedure, as well as the timeframes for disciplinary matters, we will deal with those in those respective rules and codes. I think what's important to note, and what the committee needs to note also, is that some of these disciplinary codes fall within the collective bargaining space, and there are prescribed processes that must be followed in terms of how those get amended. But there is work currently outside of this amendment bill to review those particular codes and those particular rules. So we are hoping that in those processes, some of the concerns that are raised during these parliamentary processes will then get factored into those processes. There is also a proposal that the Commission's powers to determine grievance rules be subjected to collective bargaining. I think what's important to note is that the Public Service Commission derives its powers from the Constitution. And what the Constitution says at Section 196 is that the Commission may, either of its own accord or on receipt of a complaint, investigate grievances or employees in the public service concerning official acts or omissions and recommend appropriate remedies. And what the bill does is then it allows the Commission to determine rules, which it currently does, in terms of how matters are referred to the Public Service Commission. So it is not possible for us through the Public Service Act to now subject the constitutional powers of the Commission to collective bargaining. In terms of the clause on limitation on political office, on holding political office, this particular clause is currently in the bill, and what the clause says is that a HOD and those reporting to a HOD may not hold political office. And political office is then specifically defined in the bill to reflect the position of the chairperson. A deputy nationally equivalent position, irrespective of the title designated to the position.
Marcy, we have lost the presenter, and I've seen many leaving this meeting. What's going on?
I'm here. I think Ms. Naidu will try and come back again.
Chair, maybe from my side, I think it's also the web in the DPSA, because I was also checked out.
Okay. No, that's fine.
Good day, Chair. Sorry, I'm back. I'm not sure if I should start with slide 15 again. I'm not sure where
yes,
I got
yes, from. I do, because we've missed your voice.
I don't know what happened to the network, but did you lose me at slide 15?
Yes.
So I'm going to start at the top of slide 15. So what the Public Service Amendment Bill does is that it creates a limitation on holding political office. by HODs and those reporting to HODs, and the definition of political office is also provided, but it's provided in the context of the high-ranking positions within a political party. So what we are saying that a HOD and those employees that report directly to a HOD should not hold those positions. And we have said that simply to look at, having had consideration of the decision-making powers of HODs and those persons that report directly to HODs within the administration, within the public service, and those political office bearers who have decision-making powers and then marrying the two and seeing that if you hold one or the other or both at the same time, you are likely to be conflicted in the execution of your duties. So we are saying for those two categories of employees, you are not allowed to hold political office. We have checked the constitutionality of that provision, and we are confident that that provision will withstand scrutiny. Simply again, because the Constitution allows us to limit certain rights, especially where we are justified to do so, and we feel that our justification is substantive to ensure that there is a clear delineation between the administrative roles of HODs and the political roles of persons holding political office, and that this provision will eliminate any potential conflict of interest that will arise as a result of the HODs and the employees reporting directly to those HODs their functions. I think what's also important, and it needs mentioning, is that the Municipal Systems Act has a similar provision, but the Municipal Systems Act went a bit further and it included all employees. So we are saying we have done our own scrutiny, and we believe for the public service that the provision will withstand scrutiny because we've limited it to just the two higher level echelons of the public service and not necessarily to the whole public service. In terms of clause 17, there was also concern that there are no parameters within which a head of department will determine higher salaries for employees. And what clause 17 does is an amendment to, sorry, Chair, you'll just bear with me. It's an amendment to section 37 of the Principal Act. And what we have done in that amendment to section 37 is we are simply seeking to replace the powers of the executive authority and vest those powers within the HOD. And what section 37 provides in the Public Service Act is for then the HOD to allow for higher salaries to employees who have exceptional abilities or special qualifications. But that provision, if you look at Section 37 of the Public Service Act, it says that that determination is subject to any regulations that are made by the Minister for Public Service and Administration. So we are proposing and we are suggesting as a response to that concern is that we have the public service regulations which will set the parameters for which, within which the exercise of those powers by the HOD will be subjected. In terms of clause 18, there is a concern about section 38, and this concern was raised during the parliamentary processes. And I think it's important to reflect on section 38 and how the provision has then been drafted into the bill that now sits before the portfolio committee. So when, in terms of section 38 currently, section 38 provides for circumstances where an incorrect salary or salary level or salary scale or reward is awarded to an employee. And that section provides that the employer may then correct that incorrect salary. And the section goes then further and it says that when that correction is made, it may lead to either the employee having been overpaid or the employee being underpaid. And what it says in the case of where an employee has been underpaid, the employer is required to then compensate the employee for the shortfall. So that continues to remain. And then what the section goes further and it says, in the event that the employee has been overpaid, the employee is then required to pay back that overpayment. And what we are seeking through this amendment has been to ensure that that overpayment is then regulated in terms of the Public Service Act. The Principal Act, which is the current Public Service Act, has a provision that says that the employer may deduct the overpayment from the employee's salary at its discretion, provided that that debt is owed. So the Principal Act currently allows for a department to deduct unilaterally without the consent of the employee that overpayment. What happened in 2018 is that the Constitutional Court then said that that provision to allow an employer to unilaterally deduct monies from an employee's salary without any discretion, without any parameters, was unconstitutional. So our interpretation as the department was that if we put in place sufficient mechanisms to ensure that an employer did not abuse this provision in terms of deducting monies that were unaffordable to the employee, we looked at mechanisms to craft the provision in a manner that insulated the employee from abuse, but also allowed the employer to deduct the money to recover that overpayment, which was not due in the first place to the employee. Having done that analysis and having done and set those parameters, a provision was drafted and consulted at NEDLAC. It was agreed at NEDLAC that the employer could deduct monies from the employee either with the employee's consent, or where consent was not provided, then the accounting officer, within certain parameters, could then unilaterally deduct the money. In terms of this particular slide, this is the provision that was in the bill when it was consulted and agreed at NEDLAC. What the provision says is that an accounting officer may recover such overpayment by way of deduction from the employee's salary with the consent of the employer, with the consent of the employee. And where the consent is not provided, if the accounting officer confirms, one, the amount of overpayment, two, that the employee was afforded an opportunity to make representations regarding that employee's affordability to repay the amount in monthly installments or such representation is duly considered. The third element of the framework was to ensure that the amount deducted must take into account the employee's income and current financial obligation. It also required that the accounting officer must look at the total deduction and that the deduction cannot be more than a quarter of the employee's monthly salary. There was also a provision in which allowance was made in the event that the person who owed the state money in respect of this overpayment, where that person was no longer in the employ of the department, that money would be recovered by way of legal proceedings or through monies that are owed by the state to that employee as a deduction. There was also a provision that if an accounting officer determines that an employee has assumed duties and employment in another department, the first department being owed the money can then request the second department where the employee is now employed to recover that money on behalf of the first department. So that provision was also there. There was also a provision that where an employee is affected by a deduction, so having considered all of these criteria in A, A, B, B, and C, C, and D, D, the accounting officer determines that a certain amount should be deducted from an employee. If the employee is still unsatisfied that that deduction is correct, that employee is then provided the ability to appeal that decision by the accounting officer to the relevant executive authority. and what happens and what we've provided for is while that appeal is pending, no deduction can take place. So there were very strict parameters under which deductions were being made. And that, again, I must emphasize, was deductions that could include where the employee does not consent. What happened subsequent to the NEDLAC processes is that we went to the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor to have the bill certified. And one of the responses from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor was that any unilateral deduction from an employee's salary was unconstitutional or is unconstitutional. And therefore, the view of the state law advisors was that the consent of an employee is necessary, despite the fact that the overpayment, the amount, was not going to be disputed. There was no dispute on the fact that the monies needed to be recovered, but the state law advisors were of the opinion that if you don't get the salary, if you don't get the consent of the employee, then you must commence court processes for that recovery. In our view, we think it subjects employees to very onerous court processes, which we think should be avoided. We believe that as a department that Section 38 is constitutional. We stand corrected by the state law advisors. We believe that the provision goes far enough to address the concerns raised by the Constitutional Court in the recovery of this money. We have put in processes that are very similar to what a court would consider in terms of awarding deduction amounts from salaries. So we believe that that provision should pass constitutional muster, but in terms of, again, the opinion we've received, it does not. The bill that's before Parliament now is a revised version of what was presented at NEDLAC. And what the bill currently before the committee says is that if there is an overpayment in salary, that overpayment must be recovered by way of either consent by the employee or a recovery through court processes. That is currently where we stand with Clause 18. We have noted that partners at NEDLAC have asked for this provision to be brought back. And we thought it was important to highlight how this provision has unfolded throughout the comment processes to the point where the bill is now a different version to what was agreed at NEDLAC. I think that is important to note. With that, thank you, Chair and committee members. That's the end of my presentation.
No, thank you very much, Ms. Naidu, with the presentation. Honourable members, I'm taking hands for clarities on the Public Service Amendment Bill as presented by the DPSA. I can see only one hand of Honourable Kibi. Honourable Kibi.
Thank you, Honourable.
Just hold on. Hold on, Honourable Kibi. Okay, there's a hand of Kibi will be the first one. Honourable Shriver, the second one, and the last one, Honourable Notnahan. Thanks, Honourable Kibi.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Let me also welcome the presentation and responses by the department, Honourable Chair. I think they have responded and also explained their responses and as to how do they get there. Honourable Chair, according to clause 16 limitations on holding political office. In relation to clause 16, Chair, those who report to the HOD, who is the administrative authority, should be announced as various employees report directly to the HOD at various levels of responsibility and authority. Qualifying reporting in the context of seniority and hierarchy is necessary, Chair. What is the view of the department on the principle that informs the parameter of restriction, whether it is based on proximity of the who report to the HOD, who can be the employees who are not senior, or is the principal seniority based on hierarchy change? My next one is, what impact will the devolution, have on the functioning of the executive authority? Those are my questions, Honorable Chair, and I thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kibb, Honorable Shriver.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning, colleagues. My question relates to the prohibition on holding political office. We received some submissions recommending that the definition be expanded to include members of executive committees, which I think arguably do fit within the definition of holding office within a political party. And as the official there emphasized, these are decision-making and influential positions in parties. So I would just like to hear the department's response to that particular proposal, which I think really would enhance and help execute the aims of this provision, because you could have someone who is technically not a chairperson or a secretary or whatever the case may be, but who sits on a powerful executive committee who may actually even have more powers than someone who is listed in one of these other offices. So could we please get a response on that and whether the department will consider adding that into this definition? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Schreiber, Honorable Notner.
Thank you, Chair, and also thank you to the presentation. My question will be in relation to Clause 18. What is the proposal of the department and what is its implication in relation to the advice of the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor? That will be my only question. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. Those are the few questions from them. And I will then hand over to the department, DG, to respond to questions from Honourable Members.
Thank you, Chair. The legal team will start first and then I'll come back later.
Thank you, DG. Honourable Member Kitty, the issue of holding political office and the determination of where the conflict would arise was extensively debated simply because it also impedes and affects persons' rights to belong to political parties. So we had to traverse a very fine constitutional responsibility to ensure that we didn't also then prevent all public servants from being members of political parties in that cohort of persons. What we did was to look and to ensure that we brought the provisions within the constitutional parameters. We had to look at not just seniority, but also the ability of HODs and those persons reporting to HODs in terms of their financial responsibilities as well as their decision-making responsibilities, because conflicts usually arise in those two levels, in how you make decisions and how you manage finances. And if there's conflict between that and your role as a, for example, a chairperson of a political party, that's where we see the conflict. We don't believe that persons below those levels will hold
they might hold influence, but they ultimately don't have decision-making powers. So the so in making the law, we had to be very cognizant not to to unnecessarily impede on constitutional responsibility. So we have limited it both by way of hierarchy, but also in terms of influence and responsibilities and power. So I hope that that answers the question. Honorable Member Schreiber, we haven't considered a furtherance of that provision in terms of members of who hold executive offices. Perhaps that's an engagement and work that we will do going forward, but we haven't applied our mind, and I don't want to commit my colleagues in the DPSA to something that that we haven't considered holistically. So I don't have an answer, and I don't know if DG has an answer, but I don't. In respect to the response on Section 38 and our response, as a department, we had legal opinions from senior counsel who proposed and who advised that the provisions that we had consulted at NEDLAC were constitutional. We believe as a department that the Constitutional Court had found that the provision was unconstitutional because there was just unfettered powers that were given to HODs in making deductions. So there was no parameters. And we believe that the Constitutional Court, in making that decision, required of us to go and correct that to create the parameters. The legal opinions we sourced outside of the state law advisors support the view that it is permissible to do that. In fact, there is legislation like SARS and all of that who already do that. The state law advisors, however, are of a different opinion that if you don't have the consent of an employee, you cannot then deduct overpaid salaries. Our difficulty also with this provision is has been, and our arguments with this provision is that we are not talking about all debt. We are talking about that debt which arises because an employee got a wrong salary. So if an employee should have been appointed at salary level 2 and was appointed at salary level 3, that overpayment then, as a matter of fact, gets corrected through the processes because you correct salary levels. And then there should be, there is no dispute about that recovery or that amount. It is due, it is owing, it is payable. And what we are saying in those circumstances, and only in those circumstances of overpayment of salaries and salary levels, that that money should be deducted without consent. Again, that is the view of the department, supported by external legal opinions. When we went into NEDLAC, that was the understanding of the parties as well. When we went to the state law advisors for certification, they held a different view, and we respect that view. But it is then what culminated in the revised bill that went into Parliament. Hence the concern by the social partners at NEDLAC that we have now amended that provision despite the agreement at NEDLAC. So I think the presentation is in that context that we are explaining why we have, outside of a NEDLAC process, then revised Section 38. So we would like, as the state, and we believe that as the state, we should be able to recover that money without resorting to legal proceedings. But it is now in the hands of the portfolio committee to look at the constitutionality of that. And I think they would be guided by their own legal services to look into the matter. But that is the position. And I thought it was important to explain it, especially in light of the fact that it was drawn to the attention of the portfolio committee through these processes. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was just looking at the definition, Renisha, of the political office. It's defined as position of chair, deputy chair, secretary, deputy secretary, treasurer of the party nationally or province, region, or any other equivalent. And then it or other. And then it says, or any other equivalent position. So my understanding of the question from Honorable Schreiber is a prohibition on political office, including members who are, including those who are members to the executive committee in the political party. So in context to our response, I think let's just go back and relook at the matter. My simple understanding is that any other equivalent position may actually be covering the executive committee membership of the party by a public servant at the level that is prohibited. But I think we can engage and come back to the committee on the matter. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much, DG and Ms. Naidu. I will then, honourable members, in the midst of follow-up clarities, I will give the honourable DM to do concluding remarks now after this presentation so that we move to the next item. Honourable DM.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. I've put my video on again. I think there's something wrong, probably on your side, because from my side, I've actually tried everything. I must apologize for it. I don't know what is it that is a problem. Oh, on the phone, it looks like it can be on.
Recording in progress.
There it is on the phone.
We can see you, DM.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Let me switch off the phone because now there is echo. Is that better now?
Yes, that's better.
Better. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think we just appreciate the opportunity that you've actually provided to us. You've provided to us as a committee to present the our responses on the public hearings that actually took place on the two bills, the Public Service Management Bill and the Public Administration Amendment Bill. It has been interesting to actually listen to the engagements, and it actually makes it indicates that we're really making a lot of progress on the bill. And I think what is just important is actually to indicate what I think is important that I've noted as the outcome of the process is that because the purpose of the bill is to develop an ethical, effective, and efficient, well-resourced public service that is well-resourced in terms of human and financial resources, based on Batupele principles, that is respect for the rights of others. So the intention is to harmonize government processes or government services. But in the process of doing so, I think what we need to do is to really not try to correct certain aspects of the provisions of the legislation that we've got in a way that begins to create other problems. And some of the members have actually indicated so in their inputs, and which we do appreciate as a department, because as we continue to help you to refine the bill, I think it's something that needs to be taken into consideration to the extent that we are very conscious and vigilant about the fact that harmonization doesn't mean that as you correct a particular situation that you think is actually debilitating, it should then end up creating another debilitating situation. We have to really be conscious of it. And I'm sure in our deliberations also as a committee moving forward, this is the kind of approach that we will take. Part of it is on the interface between the administration and the executive. The delineation of roles or control roles between the administration and the executive, as articulated by Honorable Gibby, I think it is correct, because the question that she was asking was, what impact will the devolution have on the functioning of the executive? And of course, we know historically we have actually lamented that there was a problem in terms of a revolving door for HODs when there's political change, to the extent that we looked at systems and mechanisms of actually ensuring that there is retention. And indeed, this is part of retention that we need to actually embrace. But embracing shouldn't actually then create a situation of exclusion. And those would be my comments, Honorable Chairperson, as we conclude our discussion for this morning. Thank you, Chairperson.
No, thank you very much, Honorable TM. And that is the last item, Marcy, for the day. And however, next week, Tuesday, you will get the presentation. That was a third item for today, but removed from the Legal Unit of Parliament. And also, Honorable DM and DG will give an opportunity to the NSG and present their amendments and next week, Tuesday. And the honorable members will have that opportunity also on Wednesday to go clause by clause of the two bills. But however, now I want to thank you all, yourself at DM, Honorable Kana, the DG, and the whole team of the DPSA, our colleagues, and also thank our support staff who are always available to assist us. And this is the last item of today. And honorable members, and officially close this meeting. The time now is 11. Yes.
Yes, sir. If you can just quickly allow Julius, sir, I think on announcement, there's something that he wants to just put through to the committee in relation to the Public Service Commission Bill. Public Service Commission Bill, sir. Thank you, sir.
So can we release the DM and also the department?
Noted, sir. Correct.
Thank you, Chair, and goodbye. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
The DG and the team, you are released, will remain as the honorable members.
Good morning, Chair President, honorable members and colleagues. Yeah, we just have an announcement, like Marcy has just slightly touched on it, that the committee has the National Assembly has officially referred to the Speaker's office the Public Service Commission Amendment Bill. So it's the third bill that the committee will speed up the process of amending such particular bill. Actually, I believe that it could have been, I'll say, good that when we are amending these two bills, we are amending them parallel with the Public Service Commission Amendment Bill, so that if there are any other loopholes that exist with regard to PSE and in the other bills, then the PSE bill will then cover such kind of loopholes. But next week, Chair, will then table the advert. I think we'll try by all the means to have an advert on Tuesday before the committee, so that we kickstart the process of amending the PSC bill, amendment bill. It's not even amendment. It's the Public Service Commission bill, because they are not amending, they are repealing the old the old act. So it's just a new bill completely. So we will table an advert next week, and then through you, Chairperson, then we'll then develop a program of which this program will have to, I think we have to compromise somewhere in January, early January, for the committee to sit, because it has to go to the NCOP before the end of this administration. So that's what we wanted to say, Honorable Chairperson. There is a bill before us that the committee has to attend to. So next week we'll also table an advert, and then thereafter develop a program for that Public Service Commission bill. Thanks, Honorable Chair and Honorable.
No, thank you very much, Mr. Mwepe. And honorable members, that's the announcement from our support staff. And we've got our last item now is the closure. And thank you very much to all of you, honorable members, and our support staff. And the meeting now is adjourned at 11:40. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Member.
Thank you, Chair.